Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is March 24th, 2022. I'm Louise Devery-Bjorkman. I'm joined on the panel this morning by Judges Jennifer Frisch and Michael Kirk. We are here now for oral argument in the second case set on for argument. That is the matter of the welfare of the child of M.W. and T.S. Counsel, I'll just remind you of our procedures. You each will have 15 minutes to present your argument, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your arguments. And as just a reminder that no one is permitted to record these oral arguments over Zoom. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Victoria Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, and I am arguing on behalf of appellant mother, Majesta Walker, known as M.W. in the court caption. I am here to ask this court to reverse the termination of Ms. Walker's parental rights. At first impression, Ms. Walker's parental rights were terminated simply because of her disability. She has a number of physical ailments, none of which interfere with her ability to lead a normal life, but she also has a traumatic brain injury. And with a traumatic brain injury, she has some mental challenges. None of them are cognitive, and they are not overly emotional either. She has the ability to lead a normal, independent life. As a matter of fact, as we sit here today and as at the time of trial, that is exactly what she is doing. My client has three children, and we are talking here today about her youngest son, who at the time of trial was two. Her older children are, I believe, 9 and 11, and she has parental rights to those children. As a matter of fact, as we sit here today and at the time of trial, she regularly parents and sees those other two children.
Although she consented to the transfer of custody to the children's father, correct?
She did indeed, yes. And I will, that is a wonderful point, thank you, that the county actually approved of that and the court approved of that as well. That was an appropriate remedy, especially during a pandemic and trying to get my client the appropriate treatment that she needed. That being said,
what type of visitation does she have with those two children? Is it unsupervised?
It is unsupervised. Well, supervised as far as just safety, just, you know, making sure that that, you know, her skills of timing, keeping them safe, not because she harms the children. Nothing like that. But yes, she has supports in place. She actually has a PCA. So there is always somebody around.
She doesn't have unsupervised visitation for like a weekend or something like that.
I would say, Your Honor, no. That within her disability, that would not be smart. And she knows that. That being said, her supervision is part of her care team. In her home, in her community, she's also gainfully employed. She actually works with, ironically, foster care youth, and she.
Let me ask you. I want to make sure that we're considering what you're saying in terms of the record before the district court. Mm-hmm. Remind me what your client's living situation was at the time of the trial.
At the time of the trial, she had just signed a lease for a two-bedroom apartment, I believe.
But she was still living, was she not, in some sort of assisted living situation?
Correct, Your Honor. She was in a group home specifically for her disability. But at trial, her case manager testified that she had all the supports in place and would be, again, independent. I would like to point out, prior to her child being removed, her entire life, she was independent. She owned a home. She was actually a pediatric nurse as well. So this is then, of course, that was prior to her disability. But she's never been a danger to her children. And I certainly know that counsel, Ms. Johnson, that's never been alleged. Her ability to parent is intact, in fact, and her disability does not support a termination of parental rights. It can't possibly be appropriate.
Wasn't there testimony at trial from the social worker that, in fact, your client had difficulty during supervised parenting time with the older children, attending to that and focusing on that for the full 2-hour period? Or am I getting that wrong?
I don't think that you're totally getting it wrong, but let me contextualize it. In fact, the social worker that testified, those observations were almost a year, at least 9 months prior to trial. In fact, the social worker, the county had been relieved from reasonable efforts 9 months before trial. And the social worker and the guardian ad litem had not seen my client, but I believe a total of a half an hour in those 9 months. There was a brief check-in, and I would say it was a couple months prior to trial. There was no recent interaction between the social worker, the guardian ad litem, or anyone else to testify as to what the standards were, where my client was at the time of trial, which, by the way, is the standard of proof at trial. The transcript is void. There is not one fact on record to support that.
Understanding, Ms. Taylor, that in fact your client did not have any burden of proof. I understand that. So please understand that's the context for this next question. What evidence was admitted at trial from any source that your client in fact would be able to, at the time of trial, safely parent this young 3-year-old child?
Well, the evidence admitted by the county was none. It was zero. It was all perspective, but there was no recent fact, certainly. And I would argue even the facts that were 9 to 12 months old would not meet the standard of proof to terminate her rights. The facts presented at trial, even though it was not my client's burden, were presented by my client and her case manager. Those two witnesses and the supporting documentation from her doctor, her other care team members, those were presented at trial about her current progress. And her progress was remarkable. In a pandemic, in 9 months from the county's reasonable efforts being relieved, she was able to get out of an ERTS facility, which arguably was not the appropriate care for her. And she was able to get care under Courage Kenny with Dr. Smallwood, who specialized in brain injury. She was employed. She had independent living set up. Her medications had gotten figured out. All of this she had done on her own with her own independent supports without any help from the county, all by herself. And if she can do that and parent two older children at the same time, how do we get here? Why am I here? I don't know. But this can't possibly be the standard that we are doing for parents and for kids. There is a 2-year-old little boy who has been ripped away from his mother and his siblings. This is his entire future. This is everything we hold dear. And if this is going to be the standard for terminating parental rights, I don't know that anybody here observing shouldn't be terrified. Because I certainly have my challenges. And I don't want that to be the standard for the state to take away my parental rights. I think what's most offensive here is how we got here. Why I'm here today is because my client, the day her child was removed, she called the other parent for the two older children, left the baby, the child we're talking about today, in the care of his father, and put herself in the hospital to seek care. Is that the message we are sending? That if you have a disability and you seek help, we will take your child away? That can't be right. This cannot be the precedent that we are setting for child protection. That's not protecting children. That is ripping families apart. And that is why I am asking this court to apply the precedent, and we have this precedent in our case law. Disability is not a reason to terminate a parent's rights. Having supports is not a reason to terminate a parent's rights. Even if she couldn't live independently in her disability, that is not a reason to terminate a fundamental right to parent. That can't possibly be where we're at. And if there are no other questions, I will relinquish my time.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, Ms. Taylor.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson, you have 15 minutes for response.
Thank you. May it please the court, I am Erin Johnson, Assistant Washington County Attorney, and I am here on behalf of respondent Washington County Community Services. What Washington County is asking today is that this court affirm the district court order in all respects. I would note that when we look at this court's standard of review, we're looking for abuse of discretion. And as a matter of course, there's a lot of deference given to a trial court's order. As this court has explained many times in many different cases, that it's the district court's determinations about the case, witness credibility, and the weight of the evidence that should be given quite a bit of deference. And unless a district court's findings are clearly erroneous and not supported by the record, they should be affirmed. I think the other thing to point out is that just because another court may have come to a different conclusion with the same set of circumstances or facts, again, does not necessarily make the district court's findings and conclusions erronious.
Ms. Johnson, I think that Ms. Taylor raised a number of important points in her argument, as she did in her brief. And I'm going to ask you to first address the question of how do we know here that the district court relied on the impact that mother's mental health issues, traumatic brain injury, had on her ability to parent versus focusing simply on the fact that mother has these challenges?
I think we see that in the findings that the district court made in its court order. There were findings specifically about her ability to parent the children, both from the beginning of the case and even up to just a few weeks before trial. The social worker actually visited and observed the mother on August 4th. So that was, like I said, about 2 weeks before trial. And she observed and testified to that at that point, she observed that the mother was still having difficulty focusing on her child for that period of time that the social worker was there. So that is, I think, where we see the impact. During the course of the case, we also saw numerous times where Ms. Walker was not available because her mental health took her out of the community and required her to be hospitalized. So that in and of itself made her unavailable, unable to essentially provide those parental duties for multiple times over the course of the case.
But again, I'm also going to have you now comment on the question of ability to parent at the time of trial. You know, I understand why a county and the law permits a county agency to ask the court to be relieved of the obligation to make reasonable efforts. And when that request is granted, as it was here, these efforts will cease. But it seems to me that creates a situation where the county doesn't have current information if they're not involved. And how do you respond to the argument that the TPR decision here was based on stale information?
Well, I think it's important to put that request to cease reasonable efforts in the context of the case as a whole. This case started in September of 2019, and the county initially filed a permanency petition for transfer of custody in October of 2020. And at that time that it was contemplated, similar to the transfer of custody to Ms. Walker's, the father of her two older children, that transfer of custody would be to the father. And quite frankly, by all accounts, it was being discussed that would occur, that some details needed to be worked out about visitation and what that might look like going forward. So that request was actually made in conjunction with that first permanency petition under some assumptions about how that case was going to proceed. And it was very similar to what happened in the case involving the two older children when, at the time that transfer of custody petition was filed, the county also asked to cease efforts as to those two children. And again, there was a lag of time between when the petition was filed and when it was actually finalized, again, for the two parents to work out parenting time and a visitation schedule. So I think the fact that reasonable efforts were ceased for so long, that was certainly not the initial intent. And I would say that the information was not necessarily stale. If you're looking at the current circumstances at the time of trial, the court received a lot of evidence about what those current circumstances were. And specifically as it related to Ms. Walker and where she was at. And if the standard, if what we're looking at is whether a parent is presently able to assume parenting responsibilities as of the time of trial, quite frankly, there was no evidence presented that she was at that point. She had made progress, absolutely. Nobody's denying that. Nobody is denying that in some respects she was in much better circumstances than she was at the beginning of the case, and certainly than she was at various points during the timeline of the case. But the fact remains is that at the time of trial, she was not in a position where her child could be returned to her care. She hadn't even been able to expand to unsupervised visits at that point. There were multiple court hearings in between the time that the first permanency petition was filed and when the termination of parental rights trial actually occurred. There was never a request from the mother to expand to unsupervised time, nor was there ever a request to reconsider the court's determination as to whether reasonable efforts should still be ceased or whether the court should vacate that order and put that requirement back on the county.
Counsel, was there any consideration given to, rather than bringing a termination petition, bringing a petition for permanent custody with a foster parent?
A transfer of custody petition? Right. Yes, there was. And what is required for that is that there needs to be a person willing to accept custody of the child. And the foster parents believed that for their family and in the best interest, what they felt was in the best interest of the child, that termination of parental and rights and adoption would best fit the needs of their family. I would also note that that is, quite frankly, the statutory preference in the state of Minnesota when we look at preferred permanency options. We start with termination of parental rights and adoption, And when you look at a transfer of custody, there has to be specific findings made that a termination of adoption and parental rights is not, in fact, in the best interest of the child. So that's the rubric we're working under.
But you would agree, counsel, this is a very unusual case.
I'm not sure how the court would indicate this is unusual. I think if the court is indicating that we started with one permanency petition and ended up with another, yes, that is fairly atypical. But I think in terms of the circumstances that brought this matter to court, where we have parents who are struggling with both mental health issues, and then as it relates to the father, chemical dependency issues, the challenges that we saw both of them face in overcoming those issues and then stumbling regarding those issues, those circumstances are fairly typical in child protection cases.
Yeah, but usually you have a little more blame associated with the parent than you do here.
I would say that really blame is not something that we are looking at when we look at child protection cases, and especially permanency. There is no intent, if you will, built into the child protection statutes. I know in Ms. Taylor's brief, she went down a similar path, indicating that Ms. Walker didn't intentionally do anything or consciously doing anything to neglect the duties of a parent-child relationship. But that language, that idea of blame or intent or whether something was conscious or not, that's not included in the statute. The fact of the matter is that we see all kinds of circumstances where parents are not to blame necessarily. It's the circumstances that they come to us with. Nobody is to blame for mental health or a traumatic brain injury, but that doesn't mean that there aren't ramifications and safety concerns as to what kind of effect that has on somebody's ability to parent.
Here's my take on this. I look at the grounds for termination here, neglect of parental duties, failure of reasonable efforts, and the child being neglected in foster care. How can we find neglect when mother seems to have done everything within her power to comply with the directives from child protection and, frankly, with the directions she was getting from her other care providers, independent of the county agency?
I think, again, it goes to that idea of, you know, when you say neglect, I think you see that in the statute where you have what it actually is, refusal or neglect. And I this is not a case where Ms. Walker refused to do anything. You know, I think that refusal piece is where you see more of that intentional action. Again, a parent's own circumstances, despite complying with the case plan, which she more or less did, can still leave them in a situation where they are not able to fulfill those parental duties. So the neglect is really, like I said earlier, a byproduct of what they are struggling with in terms of their mental health. So while Ms. Walker did, yes, make progress, again, we look at, was she able to assume those parental duties at the time of trial? And the county's belief was she was not, and there was not evidence before the court that as of the time of trial, right then, right there, she was ready to assume those duties.
But that's not an affirmative duty on mother to show that. I mean, it's the flip side of the clear and convincing evidence required of the county to show that she's not able to. And I'm struggling with the clarity of that evidence.
I think the court considered the evidence that was before him, and it's the court can make findings based on all of the evidence that was presented. It's not just limited to the evidence that the county presents. So the court listened to what Ms. Walker testified to, for example. The court listened to what her current care provider, not care provider, I apologize, I don't recall the specific title of Ms. Sundquist, but the court takes all of those pieces of information into consideration and from that determine that based on her current circumstances of living in a facility, a group home facility, where she was not able to have children present, where she was receiving still 24-hour care, where she was still receiving quite a bit of assistance with daily tasks, including coordinating her medication, assistance with forms, with paperwork, coordinating her services, and the fact that she had not essentially been independent by her own testimony. She indicated she had never lived by herself. I think it's also important to note that at the time of trial, she was still having supervised visits with her two older children. And that was a part of the transfer of custody petition, and the stipulation is very clear in that stipulation that she had to have supervised visits until she had demonstrated for at least a year that she was able to be stable and function within the community. And then that was going to be revisited. So all of those circumstances existed at the time of trial. And that's what the court based the decision on. I would also note, as my time concludes, that both parents actually did have the option under the law when the county's termination petition was filed to file a transfer of custody petition. And while the foster parents had indicated that they would not accept a transfer of custody, that did not preclude either parent from filing a transfer of custody petition to somebody else. So that option certainly was available, and it did not happen. So that left the court with the termination petition to consider, and the court did consider that. There's ample evidence in the record, whether it's through the exhibits that were filed or through the testimony of all of the witnesses, not just the county's witnesses, to support the district court's order. So again, I am respectfully asking this court to affirm the district court's decision today. Thank you.
Ms. Taylor, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I just want to hit on a couple of points. Parents aren't required to live by themselves. As most of us have supports within our lives, even if we're not disabled. But that being said, let's pretend that Ms. Walker was wheelchair ridden or she was paralyzed. In that circumstance, she might live in a different sort of living situation and would require assistance. Would we then terminate her parental rights? I hope not. As a matter of fact, we don't. I mean, that's the holding of this court, is that we don't just simply terminate parental rights based on a parent's disability. And that is what has happened here. The other piece of this is we also don't terminate parental rights based on prospective information that could happen. As a matter of fact, I hope we don't do that, because by the grace of God, I could go out today and something could happen. I don't know. I don't want the standard to be if I make a bad choice, not that I'm planning to, but if I make one bad choice, the county's going to come and round up my child and terminate my relationship and my parental rights to my child. Look, you know, in the state of Minnesota, and I would say around the country, we have parents who have disabilities parenting their children. Those parents have supports in place. They have MS. They are in wheelchairs. Some of them are paralyzed. They're blind. They're deaf. You name it. And we don't terminate parental rights based on disability. We just don't do it. And there's nothing other than that fact in the trial record that the court based its decision on in this particular case. The other piece of it is nothing at trial. And I was there, and I've pored over the transcripts, and I've written the brief. And maybe I missed something, but there is nothing in the record that Ms. Walker, there are safety concerns. Nothing. It's all what if. What if, what if, what if. What ifs aren't facts. And we cannot terminate parental rights on what ifs. My last point is, how do we define parental duties? I really caution us all to define them to look like whatever cultural context it is. I mean, is it you have to live in a 3-bedroom house? Do you have to drive a beige minivan? Do you have to live in a gated community? What is that? What does that look like? We are a diverse people, full of diverse cultures, living situations, cultures, and disabilities. What are we going to define as lack of parental duties? Isn't the fundamental parental duty of a parent to be present in the child's life, to have a relationship and guide them? Yes, you care for them. But if you've got a disability, you have help for that. And you know, this particular mom, she knows that. She was a nurse. That's how she got here. She went and sought treatment. That's how she got here. And she's still above and beyond, even through all of this and through a pandemic, did that. I would argue that my client did far more to prove her parental abilities than I think maybe any of us were ever called to do. And so do I think, sitting here today, that she could parent this child with the supports in place? I absolutely, absolutely 100% think she can. I know she can. And there are any facts on the record to support anything that she can't, much less her parental rights being terminated. And with that, I thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your presentations today and your